This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 137. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-88-167-691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Berners and Mark Garraway. Welcome to the show, everyone. Hi, Berners. Hi, Garraway. How's it going?
Hello, David. How are you?
Yes, keeping busy. It's a beautiful late autumn / early winter's day here, and the sun's streaming through my window. So I love this time of year. It's time to start thinking about Christmas. I know it's early, absolutely. But it's never too early to start thinking about Christmas, is it?
Quite right, too.
Winter depression setting in London, I must add.
Yeah, dark by 4 o'clock, but that doesn't matter.
My postman's still wearing shorts.
Oh, well,
brave man.
You can't argue with that, yeah. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about cricket, shall we? So what's been going on, Berners? You've had your eye on the pulse this week?
Yeah, there's been lots of action going on. We've got quite an intriguing test match in Cape Town, which has taken place. And also the West Indies are battled hard against India to no avail. But I think that they proved a few people wrong at the start of that campaign.
Yeah, well, of course, they got friend of Pitch Vision, Des Haynes, working with their batsmen. So they can't go wrong, can they? The man with the best leave in the history of cricket. he claims, of course, we did some filming with him recently, and you'll be able to see some of that on the site shortly. But he claims that he never played a missed at one. It was always him just moving the bat out of the way just in time, because his leave was almost exactly the same as a play and miss, wasn't it?
Yeah. I saw him in a hotel in the Port of Spain one day, and I was having a chat with him, and an Indian fellow walked over to him and said hello, and he's talking away. And when he left, I said, "Oh, who's that, Des?" He said, "Oh, that's Sunil Gavaskar." He says, "Never as good as me."
We love it.
Yeah. I didn't know Sunil Gavaskar was, but never mind.
I said to him, "How do you once asked him, how do you play really, really good bowling when the bowler's on top of you? What do you do?" And he said, "Well, when you got Gordon Greenwich and Viv Richards at the other end, all I need to do is get a single," which is probably the best answer to give.
He gave me, because he coached at Hampshire for a summer, was my batting coach for a summer. And he was fantastic. I mean, typically West Indian in the way that he went about things, and you know, didn't give you a lot of technical advice. But one of the best bits of coaching advice I ever got from him was, the first thing I'm going to teach you, Gary, is you make sure that you got a really good bat in your hand. He said, because if you mess it up and you've got a good bat, then it'll still go over the top. And if you've got a crap bat, then you're going to get caught. And that was absolutely brilliant. I went, oh, fair enough.
It's not a bad bit of advice. I mean, I've seen people with a pretty decent stick. And because the thing is, if you hit a couple in the middle, you really gain confidence, don't you, in your ability. And you kind of go through with a shot. And if you have got a half-decent stick, they don't half-ping these days with the, well, you see the guys going out to bat in the IPL. They've got railway sleepers underneath their arms half the time.
Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, it's such a simple bit of advice, but actually, he's right. And you see so many people buying off of the internet now and not really knowing what they're buying. Mm. I think, you know, there's a real danger that people end up using bats that aren't appropriate for them or don't go well enough. And then as a consequence, as you say, the confidence goes down. And, you know, the IPL is a classic example. Some of the Indian bats that are being made now are unbelievable. And you can go out there and you know that you're going to get away with it if you don't get it 100% right.
That is an amazing thing. I remember I borrowed someone's bat for a pre-season friendly once, and he said, "Oh, you know, this is a good bat." He said, "I really like it. Brilliant. I'll nab it off you." And I remember just gently stroking an on drive a second ball or something, and it absolutely flew off the middle of the bat. Unfortunately, they had a guy out on the boundary because it was toward the end of the innings, and I thought, "Hello, I'm going to have some fun here," because it pinged like nothing else. And then the guy at the other end managed to give me a good old yes, no, wait, sorry. and ran me out without me facing another ball. So I never got to use it. I was so excited after that first shot for one. I thought I was going to smash it all over the place and then got run out without facing another ball. So it just goes to show, it's not always about the bat. Sometimes you have a partner who knows what they're doing.
So a lot of my teammates at Ealing tend to use their bats more in the changing rooms when they've just got out, and they stick it through the plasterboard insert that's in the changing room, full of holes, that place. Changing the subject, what about the acquisition of a new coach? Often quite a few trials and tribulations amongst players and board alike with those kind of decisions. What do you reckon the kind of key factors are in a new coach to a certain team? A lot of coaches in football and cricket now are kind of going further afield and getting international coaches on board. Do you think that's kind of the done thing in cricket these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gone a bit full circle. And in county cricket, certainly, there was a big thing about getting overseas coaches in there. But now, because of the ECB in particular, have got some really good coach education systems in place. And with the level four coaching course being as strong and as in-depth as it is, you're finding now that actually counties and cricket clubs are employing English coaches because they're the best educated, got the best education system in the world. But looking at Australia, I mean, I can't ever see a day where a non-Australian's going to coach Australia. I don't know about you two, but I think that they'll always go for Australians.
Yeah, well, the thing that often crosses my mind is you've seen it with a few of the past greats, the likes of Alan Donald, and I know that England have got Saker at the moment, but, you know, you've got guys who have played for other countries that are potentially sat in the dugout playing against their nation of birth and the side they've played for years. I mean, what do you reckon's going through their head half the time as they're sat there when they're almost beating their own, you know, their own best mates kind of thing?
Well, I can only talk from my own experience, but I had exactly that when Ireland played England. So, you know, you just get on with it. And in fact, you probably want to beat them more than you do any other team that you come across. And that certainly was my approach when I was working with Ireland. Whenever we played against England, it was a massive match, and you just did anything you could to get a win as you would do in any other game. But yeah. But working with the likes of Otis Gibson when we played West Indies, Alan Donald when we were playing South Africa, Troy Cooley obviously was a good one when we played against Australia. Those guys were so committed to what they were doing, and I think it adds an extra little bit of motivation rather than confuses. But it's a question I'm always asked whenever we were playing England is, you know, where do your allegiances lie? Well, your allegiances lie with the team that you're representing, yeah, and the team that you're working with, full stop.
It seems to me that there's a change, a shift, if you like, in selecting coaches. And I think this is happening at all levels, not just at the professional level. I think it's happening at club level as well, where the coach was entirely built on a mystique and a reputation that they had, and now it's a lot more quantitative, if you like. You know, it's based on things that are a bit more measurable. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I would do, and you can measure things. I mean, it's difficult to measure an effectiveness of a coach, but you can obviously measure results. You can assess somebody's ways of managing relationships, because that's massively important at any level of coaching is how you manage relationships. Because without relationships, you can have the best information in the world, but if you haven't got those relationships, then people don't listen, or they don't take the information in. So, and that happens everywhere. So you can assess that, but results ultimately are crucial. And you know, you can be as good a coach as you want, but if your team don't win, you don't stay in a job very often. And we see that in football management heck of a lot, and we're beginning to see it in cricket as well. If your results aren't up to scratch, then they give it somebody else a go, and that happens at club level as well, doesn't it? I mean, we look around and a lot of clubs are getting coaches now, and there's a bit of turnover if a side doesn't do very well, and obviously people stay in their jobs if a side exceeds expectation.
So let's give this a practical bent for a club side, say, who are looking for a coach, looking for someone to manage their youth section, perhaps, or someone to help look after the first team. What would be the sort of top three or four things that a management committee of a club should look for when they're trying to select a coach beyond just reputation?
Well, I mean, if you go through any recruitment process, you look at qualification to start off with, and you'd probably have a desirable or essential on a whatever level it may be. And obviously, if you know level two for a club coach that's running a youth section, maybe, or a level two for a club first team coach, so that would be the starting point. And then you look at experience, and the next questions would be, can you give examples of how you've managed teams in the past, or how you've worked with young players in the past, and so it would be very much an experience based approach to that, because otherwise, you know, you'll just get in a player who was quite good because he was quite good. He'll be able to talk about it and be able to coach, and it doesn't always work like that, as we've discussed previously. So yeah, it's qualification and then experience would be the two things that would be part of the recruitment process.
Yeah, I think experience to what you're level or wherever you're playing is the critical thing, isn't it? You know, if you've got people that are coming from an elite level down into a club that maybe don't quite have the same facilities at their disposal, or they don't have the same ability at their disposal, it's probably not going to work out too well for either party.
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, you ask questions as in any recruitment process of how you cope with pressure, how you cope with adaptation, you know, and what, that's a great, what you talked about there, an elite coach or a level three coach going into a club setup. You know, it is different. So you'd probably want to ask about how you do adapt you around your circumstances and how your environment impacts upon what you do. So, you'd definitely ask questions about that. And, you know, you see clubs are becoming more and more professional now, aren't they? I watch a lot of local league cricket. And the warm-ups and the organisation is definitely improving, which is a fantastic thing to see. And you're now seeing level three coaches coaching in first team cricket around the clubs, which is fantastic.
On the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we try and cover the whole gamut of cricket, and some weeks we talk to top international players like JP Duminy and former Ashes winning captains like Mike Brearley. And sometimes we talk to the people who are doing it at the coalface, who are helping develop those guys from a participation level. And this week we're talking to Stuart Cope, who's cricket development officer for Surrey, covering Inner London, which is quite a big area to cover. Stuart, how do you do it? You must drive very fast.
Yeah, it can be hard, to be honest, David. The areas I cover, which are Wandsworth, Lambeth and Southwark, I think there's 5 million people which live in those areas, and also a massive lack of green space. So it can be a bit of a taxing role, but one that I'm also very passionate about. So yeah, hard work, and hopefully try and get as many people playing and developing cricket as possible. So
what do you do day to day? You know, people don't necessarily think of inner cities as a place where cricket can thrive. So what's a day like for you, a typical day like for you, say, in the summer?
It's a bit of a strange role, really. There's loads of different aspects to it. Obviously, I'm called a cricket development officer. It's basically developing cricket from the grassroots players, so players which are in schools, women's cricket, and developing school competitions. We do a lot of community-based projects as well around the Oval in Surrey. My role as well also covers disability cricket throughout the whole county, and also as well doing high-performance coaching with the Surrey age group. So there's quite a lot of areas that I have to cover. And each day is pretty much different, which in some aspects is great because it keeps me motivated in the job, but also keeps me captain as well. So, yeah, it's a job that I enjoy and one that I'm very passionate about.
How much do you have to split the balance between encouraging talent and getting talented players to develop and just getting people to participate no matter whatever level they're at?
That's a difficult question. In London, it is very difficult. The three boroughs that I work within, you've got Wandsworth and Southwark, and there's actually quite a lot of cricket being played within those two areas. But then also Lambeth, where the Oval is based, it's a huge borough with a lot of people there, but there is a lack of cricket that goes on, basically just due to lack of sports facilities, lack of space, and also lack of funding. Isn't a lot of funding out there to set up projects. Obviously, the Surrey Cricket Board, we try and pump up as much money as we can into the community, but end of the day, if you can't get funding, it is very hard to set up community-based projects. What we try and do at Surrey is utilise parks, for example, school playgrounds, local sports halls, and try and use even the Cambrian Centre at the Oval as much as possible. But it's not like being in the leafy suburbs of Surrey where there's, let's say, 75% of our cricket clubs thrive. There seems to be a lacking in London, so it is difficult, but we have to do everything we can with as certain amount of money as possible to get kids, to get adults, to get disability players playing. So it is a tough role. It's something that the ECB is really striving for, especially even adult participation. Cricket, as you know, is a sport that time-wise takes up a lot of time. Also, it can be very expensive to play. So at Surrey, we're looking at various new formats of the game to get not just adults, but kids as well playing. So we really are pushing the last man standing competitions within London. It's a great way of getting more adults playing over a short amount of time, and also it's very cost effective, and it can be played in any park within London as well. Also, 2020 cricket has helped massively, and also we're pushing indoor competitions as well.
Now, you've played quite a bit yourself, and you've had some success. You've managed to play at representative level. What's that like, you know, for somebody who's, say, a young person who's listening and they are, you know, they're ambitious and they want to move on from playing club cricket? What's the jump like to moving up to kind of rep level cricket?
Rep level compared to club level, and this is by no means I'm being derogative towards club level, it's just basically more consistent. You just tend to find that the bowlers tend to put the ball in the right areas more often than not. Fielders are a little bit sharper, the quicker getting the ball in and out, more catches seem to stick, and basically it takes less time for fielders to get the ball. It is just a more consistent, more concise game playing rep team level, and also you're probably playing on, you tend to find that in rep teams as well, they're generally better prepared, so that can be from warm-ups to also analysing the opposition, bowling to set plans, which you don't tend to find in club cricket. The best club is prepared, and it seems that when you step up a level, rep teams should be prepared because obviously there'll be more money there and the players are usually of a better standard. Also as well in club cricket, it's kind of strange. You always fancy yourself on a Saturday. If you take early wickets, you'll break into the side. You'll get into the order pretty quickly. So if you take three or four quick wickets, you tend to see a team fall away. But in rep cricket, by no means number seven or eight are still decent batsmen, and that's also looking at the other side of bowling. Club cricket, you see off two of their strongest bowlers in club cricket. In rep cricket, there's no let-up. The openers come off, the first change bowler's probably equally as good. First spinner comes on. If it's turning, another spinner comes on, there are the same standard as well. So it's just a more consistent, basically better standard.
Is there a secret to sort of getting spotted by somebody who can select you for a rep level? How did you do it?
How did I do it? I can remember playing some district games when I was, I think, 13 in Lincolnshire. That's where I grew up, and then I got picked by a guy called Mark Fell to play county age groups from there. A lot of players do go under the radar and get missed, but if you've got the right person looking at you, he'll look at your attributes physically. Have you got something that could potentially make you go on to play professional cricket? Have you got the natural ability that's above the norm? And basically, is your technique tight enough? If you tick those three boxes, then a coach that does select you for a rep team or a county age group, there's no reason why you shouldn't get selected. But I think they're the main three reasons. But also, it's down to a lot of luck as well. You could be the most naturally gifted player in the world, but if you don't get seen, you're not going to get picked. So a lot of it does come down to luck.
And finally, you must have an ambition for how you want to see your patch in the future, the vast inner London area. What's your sort of ideal future for cricket in inner London?
To basically hit the targets I get given. So I'm quite recent to the job, to be honest, and I've been given targets to hit every year. And if we hit those targets, we get more funding from the ECB. So it's very important that I get all levels of cricket increasing in participation. So for me, it's just getting as much cricket played within my three boroughs as possible. There's nothing better to see than when I'm driving through into London and I see a game that I've set up being played, but it's being run by other people because I am only one person. I can only do so much. But it would just be to get as many people playing and to get as many community-led projects being hosted as possible. But also, as well, another downside is disabilities cricket within Surrey's not really been to the potential it could be, and my aim within the next year is to get four community-based clubs set up throughout the county, which host disabilities cricket, and from there we'll try and set up leagues, and from the leagues obviously the players hopefully filter into the Surrey disabilities team. So that would be my aim over the next year.
Well, Stuart, thank you very much for your time. If for anyone who's listening and they're in the inner London area, then make sure you you get involved in community cricket, because it'll help Stuart reach his goals. Thanks a lot, Stuart.
No worries, David. Take care, mate. All the best.
Time now for the questions section on the show, and as you already know as a regular listener, the chance to win a prize is ever present in this section of the show, and that prize is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com, so you can get your videos, your worksheets, your audio and your ebooks all in one place. If you head over to pitchvision.com/academy, you can find out more about those courses that we do from big names like JP Duminy, Andy Caddick and Mike Brearley. So in order to win one of those prizes, you need to send in a question, and Berners has got the questions this week. So Berners, what's the first question out of the mailbag?
We've got a question here from AJ Patel. AJ's an opening bowler, and he's just developed a bit of a bad habit, and he's looking for a bit of advice regarding that. He's saying that as he goes to release the ball, the right hand side of the ball, his fingers are rolling down it, so he ends up bowling an off cutter. And because of this, he's unfortunately slowing the ball down and he's unable to swing the ball at all. So he's tried a few things, but he was just looking for some expert advice about what he could do, possibly as he's releasing the ball, to stop this.
Sounds like a classic piece of the human body doing that amazing thing that it does, which is compensating. So always difficult to describe a bowling action on a audio show. So Gareth, over to you.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is difficult without seeing, but generally when the fingers come from behind the ball and the wrist stops coming from behind the ball, it's as a consequence of something happening beneath you. And you hear a lot of coaches say, oh, you need to keep your wrist behind the ball. Well, that's an obvious thing, but the question that always should come back from a player is, right, how? And ultimately, the thing that normally happens is, particularly with fast bowlers, is that if a front arm is long and languid, then it doesn't start the chain of movement. So if you look at somebody like a Brett Lee, who really pulls his arm into his side and bends his arm and drives it into his side, that then leads to a chest drive and everything's squaring up at ball release. And when you square your chest up at ball release, it's very difficult not to keep your wrist behind the ball, because your wrist and your chest will be square to the target, and then your fingers will be behind the ball, and it will stop that off-cut action. Then if you want to build an off-cutter in, then you make that conscious decision to turn the wrist and take your fingers from behind the ball and put some off-cut onto it. But my advice would be to really drive that front arm into the side. Watch Brett Lee, copy Brett Lee's drive into the side of the body, which then facilitates a chest drive and squares everything up to the target. And you'll find that the fingers will come behind the ball, and then the seam will go down the pitch, and then that swing will come back.
It sounds obvious, but the shoulders are connected to each other. So if you kind of get one one of them right, then the other one tends to follow it automatically. So it's a good tip. I think that thing about chest drive as well, as Ian Pont always says, it's as if the batsman is holding a piece of rope which is tied around your chest and is yanking you towards him when you reach the crease. So if you can get those shoulders all in the right place, then the job's done.
But the role of that front arm is absolutely crucial because that starts the process. It's something that I've worked a lot on with players over in Ireland because a lot of the Irish players had quite weak front arms and bowled with their right shoulder rather than bowling with their action. So we worked on that and got some really good results out of the younger bowlers because their consistency went up in a very natural fashion.
Again, it's another one of those things which is kind of obvious to say, but people forget. But, you know, it is the bowling action is a chain of events, which everything has to happen in the right order. And if one thing gets out, then that's ruined it for the rest of the action. The body's really good at compensating, trying to make up for it, because you know that you want to make the ball land on a specific spot. So your body's doing everything it can to make the ball land on the specific spot, even if something goes wrong. So it's extremely clever, actually, of your body to try and do that. So, you know, you shouldn't be too disheartened by the fact that you're bowling off cutters. It's your brain working overtime to try and do the right thing. But, a little bit of correction of alignment and it's all good.
The next question comes from Mohammed Ramzan Noor Remat. That's quite a name. And he's a left-arm fast bowler, and often left-arm fast bowlers struggle with various parts of the game. And he just literally was looking for some key tips and pointers that could help him with his left arm over.
Well, I think left-armers have some unique problems and also some unique opportunities, don't they? I mean, it's, you know, the classic is all to do with angles, you know, that because angles are different and people aren't used to the way that left-armers bowl compared to right-armers, you can utilize swing and angles to your benefit. I also think that the big challenge, I think, for left-armers is, perhaps there's no way of proving this, but I think the big challenge for left-armers is to be able to get the ball to swing at pace, because it tends to be, because of the angle, you tend to close your action off a little bit more before you can generate enough pace because you're getting the ball to swing.
Yeah, it is about angles, isn't it? And you're right. If you think about a right-handed batter facing a left-arm bowler and the ball's booming big time, in terms of their alignment, they've actually got to almost block themselves off a little bit to get it to start on a line that's going to bring off stump into play. And as a result, sometimes you find that bowlers lose a little bit of pace because they have to bowl slightly round themselves to get the ball on the right starting line. So that's something always to look out for. And using the crease, I wrote an article about using the crease as a right arm swing bowler the other day in the coach education section. And the same thing sort of applies for the left armer, because what tends to happen is as the ball starts to swing big, a left armer wants to get really close into the stumps. And actually what they can do is just work themselves back over to mid crease, and then they'll find that their angles are working for them rather than having to bowl round themselves to compensate to get the ball on the right line. So if you're a left armer, have a look at the article which is written about right arm bowlers, but see how that relates to you when the ball swings. I think it, you know, it's very transferable. I believe a left arm is a massive opportunities, and I love working with left arm swing bowlers and quick bowlers, because they've got so many bits in them that actually can work. So a great example of that was 2007 World Cup with Nathan Bracken, who bowled his swing up front, opened the bowling and bowled his swing up front, and was obviously very dangerous and a very good performer. And he had that ball that goes across the right-hander that brings slip into play early on, as well as the one that bends back in towards the stumps. But then he went around the wicket towards the end of the innings with Adam Gilchrist up to the stumps and bowled a combination of balls angling into the stumps, which tucked up the batter for room to get his arms to go, and then bowled a cutter that went away from the right-handed batter. And in some of the games, he was almost unplayable on those wickets that grip a little bit. So I think around the wicket is a great option for a left-armer, and also that needs to be practiced, because obviously one of the challenges for a left-armer going around the wicket is staying off the danger area on the pitch with his follow-through. So that's something that he needs to get really, really good at. And so left-armers, to me, give me a left-armer any day of the week, and I think you can work wonders with them.
Yeah, and I think it's as simple as just practicing it. And one thing I see a lot at club level is, with all bowlers, not just left-armers, with all bowlers, is very, very rarely is going round the wicket something that's practiced. You know, that everyone rocks up in their nets and bowls their over the wicket and off they go again. And it's nobody thinks about the tactical advantages of the other way. And it's even better for left armers than it is for right armers, because of those angles that they can get.
Yeah, I mean, they can get LBWs both over and around the wicket, whereas it's very difficult for a right-arm bowler, unless he bowls a little bit like Mike Proctor and swings it in miles, to get an LBW from around the wicket, because the angles obviously mean that the ball's likely to pitch outside leg stump to hit the stumps, which obviously takes LBW out of the equation. But just going back to that around the wicket, Malcolm Marshall was a huge fan of going around the wicket when the ball wasn't swinging, because it created an angle that brought the slips into play. A natural angle without having to get the ball to deviate through the air, which is obviously something that he could do at will. But every now and again, when the ball didn't swing for him, he'd go around the wicket. And the two things that he did, he said it made his bouncer a different proposition because it came from a different angle, and it brought the slips into play when the ball wasn't swinging, which I thought was great advice.
Okay, so it's time for a new feature on the show. It's the soapbox. So we're each going to be having a turn every week to get onto our soapbox and have a rant about something that's been bothering us. And of course, Berners, the king of the rants, is going to be the first man out of the blocks with this week's rant. So Berners, you've got 60 seconds. It's over to you.
Well, it's been something that's been on my mind for quite some time now. It's only come into play the last couple of years, really. But it's just kind of England's inclusion of a number of non-English specific players. Having been a bit of a globetrotter myself, I've made lots of friends in Australia and South Africa. And it's every time Kevin Peterson scores 100 or Andrew Strauss does something, it's they're not English, they're not this, they're not that. At the end of the day, face it, by hook or by crook, they've got the three lines on their chest, whether they've lived here, they were born here, or they just quite simply wish they are English. They're scoring runs and making our international side fantastic. It's your loss. You should have picked him. You should have probably nurtured him as well, which is a lot of the case these days. They're coming to our beautiful English surrounds for a career in cricket, and it's as simple as that. They're playing for us, and we're the world's number one, and I thank you.
I like it.
But if you go back far enough anyway, every Australian's English anyway, aren't they? So.
All right. Let's not turn it into a political debate, coach.
Okay, so after that lively few minutes, we're going to call an end to the show quickly before we start getting angry emails. So I expect the mailbag to be full next week of Australians giving us what for, and South Africans. But
it's before Gareth tells us he's from Cape Town.
No, Swindon, mate. Me.
Born and bred. So yes, we're going to draw a veil over this show before it gets any worse. And just a quick bit of housekeeping before we go, which is of course we've got to give away the prize, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So Gareth, we had a couple of questions this week, and who is it who wins the online coaching course prize? Who had the best question?
Today I'd say it was AJ Patel.
Well done, AJ, for having as short as possible a name, and unlucky Mohammed Ramzan Noor Ahmad for having an extremely long name. But that's the way these things go. Sometimes you can win a prize on the thinnest of reasons.
David, are you suggesting that I chose my decision based on the names there?
I would never imply so.
I'm going to contest that. I thought they were both very good questions, but I particularly liked AJ's.
But anyway, if you've got a short name, then you can email in your question to us, or you can send it through on Twitter, or even you can call us. So, Berners, how do you do that?
You can give us a call on 02088 167 691, or alternatively, drop us a mail. It's coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, indeed, and you can get us on Twitter. It's at PV Cricket Coach, and we are hanging around on Facebook. If you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you can find us there. You can also find us in iTunes. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy and we will come up. And if you don't use iTunes, you want to listen to us on your phone or something like that, then you can head over to pitchvision.com/academy, and the feed details are there for sticking into any other podcast reader. So that is the end of the show. So until next week, thanks very much, Gareth and Bernard.
Cheers, David.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, man.